All right. So, you and I met, about a month ago?
Yeah. Second visit here.
And so what we're going to be doing over the course of the next month is we're going to be doing podcasts with all of the new faculty members. So we'll do one with you, do
Very
one
cool.
with Lukasz, do one with Mike Mitchell. I don't know if you know uh-huh. Mike.
We've met over email, but not in person. Yeah.
And then also we'll be doing one with Conrad Cording, who'll be coming in
in January,
I think. But I remember you told me that that you had grown up in New Zealand.
Yes.
How has that affected the way that you look at the world, look at science, look at other stuff?
Yeah, so our family moved there in 1996, I think, and we lived there for 10 years, and I went to part of middle school and all of high school and college there. And I think it affected me very deeply because they go about things, I think, intellectually in a slightly different way.
How so?
And I think some of the values that I really picked up there were an appreciation for doing things in a very pragmatic way. So they have this kind of philosophy there that's called the number 8 wire type of philosophy, which is that you make do with the materials that you have.
Huh.
And it kind of, it rewards new and innovative approaches to either practical problems or, in my case, scientific problems.
Right,
so
right.
The people that really influenced me at the University of Auckland, for example, had that kind of wily spirit of innovation. And also this, you know, this focus on challenging perhaps the standard or traditional ways of doing things with the benefits of, you know, hopefully making an idea practical given the constraints that you have in a kind of an island nation like New Zealand.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that for a lot of Americans, the conception that we have of New Zealand is bipolar. On the one hand, it seems to us, you know, and I think rightfully so, because it's so far away and so few of us ever get there, that it must be just so wildly different. Things mm-hmm. must be so so much the opposite of the way that things are done here. But at the same time, you know, with the exception of Australia, you know, you've fought in every war with New Zealand, fought in every war with the United States since World War I.
Right.
And one of our closest alliances, obviously English speaking and all of that.
Absolutely.
So we just kind of, we sort of fumble our way around trying to understand New Zealand, I think,
right.
to a large extent.
Yeah, and it's small, and I think its history is really interesting, and my father's side of the family, you know, has fairly deep roots in New Zealand, is at least as far as you know European influences.
Right.
But they're a nation of people that from all sorts of different backgrounds. Many of them, you know, are descendants of adventurers and people that were willing to take a risk to go to such a small place.
Yeah.
And so that you do find a lot of. I think that's reflected in the scientific spirit, is this idea of. Not necessarily rebellion, but thinking differently and being adventurous in the way that we do things.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So you went to college at the University of Auckland, you said?
Right.
Did you guys live in Auckland, or were you in Wellington or someplace
else? We lived in Auckland the entire time that we were there. And so, we lived in Mount Eden mostly, I think was the neighborhood that we lived in. And it was a city, it was kind of a city-based campus, a lot like Penn in many ways.
Yeah. Although, how many people in the city of Auckland?
I would say about 1 million.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's larger than I thought.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it's very similar to any other type of city, but it's perhaps, you know, the only one of that size in New Zealand.
Right,
so
right.
It has that kind of...
So it's the largest city, then?
Yes.
But not the capital, right?
That's right, Wellington.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the capital.
So you went to college at the University of Auckland and then came here to the States. Was there a particular time that you remember thinking... biomedical, bioengineering is really sort of the way that you want to go.
In my undergrad, I found myself, I did chemical engineering for my primary degree, and I also did some pharmacology. I have mm-hmm. a degree in pharmacology. And I was always very interested in this opportunity to integrate engineering concepts with the study of biological processes. And I was really interested in both of those things. And so I feel lucky now, looking back, to be able to come to Berkeley for my graduate school, studies, but I didn't have any real conception about bioengineering. So Auckland has a bioengineering institute, and it did at that time, but it was focused on things like computer modeling of different organ systems.
Yeah.
Whereas in the United States, you know, even in 2008, people, chemical engineering, for example, was becoming very integrative, and people were starting to do very deep types of biological engineering, looking at cells as engineerable objects, and that was a very new idea for me. And I ended up specializing in working with fluids and proteins and different biological species in these microfluidic channels, we call them. So there's this field called microfluidics where you can basically almost take a computer chip type approach to biological processes and measurements. And that field was completely new to me. I don't think I'd even heard the word microfluidics until I got to the United States. So that really opened up the ability to do that type of integrative research, which I was striving to do in New Zealand, but perhaps was like a little bit, definitely less developed than it was at a place like Berkeley.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that's been going on here at Penn in the engineering school is a sort of progressive blurring of the boundaries between the disciplines in the six departments.
Right.
You know, chemical, electrical, mechanical as well, I guess, really in terms of people looking at things like, you know, fluid mechanics in biological systems, mm-hmm. and even, you know, like potentials between cells and electrical engineering and things like that. So it's really kind of, and then of course at Penn you have the medical school really nearby, which is I think a really nice thing to have.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you went out to Berkeley after Auckland. I also saw, by the way, in looking at your resume, that you spent some time at the Marine Biological Laboratory.
Yes.
So
yes.
What was that about? Because I found that was unusual.
Yeah, so the Marine Biological Laboratory, it's in Woods Hole, and they are probably best known for holding a series of summer courses going back many years. And I was accepted into this physiology course, which I think was six or eight weeks. So it's a very long and intense course. But I did it at the start of my postdoc, where I was trying to augment some of my more almost diagnostic or kind of measurement technology development side of the research I was doing with a broader understanding of single cell behaviors, collective cell behaviors, how to measure and manipulate cells in the context of living systems. And the physiology course was extremely valuable for that.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of a fixed class size, there's a rotating set of instructors that do 2-week blocks, and so you get deeply thrown into some hot topic in physiology under the guidance of people that have been doing that work for years.
Right.
Often, you know, young hotshot professors that are, you know, driving forward the new era in those particular whatever kind of subfield they'd chosen for their 2-week module. So you get for me it was a huge leg up towards understanding the techniques that I needed to really progress my postdoc towards the areas that I was interested in.
Yeah.
And it was also, you know, incredibly important for building connections with other young scientists that, you know, are currently, you know, doing this process in terms of applying for faculty or becoming other leaders in the scientific endeavor in the United States.
Right. What was the hot topic that you got thrown into when you went there?
Well, I was actually really lucky to work with a woman called Jennifer Lippincott-Schwartz,
mm-hmm.
Who is one of the world leaders in understanding organelle biology. So that was a very, to me, a very enlightening experience in the area of working with cells in the purest form, so trying to understand cellular physiology. And she had some very talented students and postdocs that were instructors for that module. And so I think the projects were, they're always like a little bit slapdash, but the thing that I remember the most was the interactions with her, because she would always come in, you know, in the evening, and we would work late at night, and often we'd work 12, 16-hour days even.
Wow.
But she would come in the evening, and she would just be looking at the data that we're getting in real time and just posing questions. And she's one of the most creative people that I've ever met. And so I think she really stood out as someone that I was just amazed at her command of almost kind of the scientific language, being able to bridge different disparate ideas into hypotheses that we could test.
I think that that's, you know, like I was saying to your mother when I was speaking to her a little bit ago, that I've only been in this job 7 months, and I don't know the extent to which I really fully understood what distinguished engineering from other areas of the sciences.
Right.
And I see more and more, and it's been an increasing conversation that we've had in the department since I've been here, that it's really this creativity aspect of it that plays an enormous role in being able to sort of see a scientific problem and solve it, of course.
Right.
But to bring that element of creativity into it and sort of really innovate and come up with something that hasn't been done before, hasn't even been sort of thought of before.
And I think what engineers can bring in that context also is an understanding of principles, physical principles, engineering principles, principles of how mass and energy are processed and flow through biological systems. So they can almost provide a framework for not just understanding biological observations, but also to perhaps build and kind of synthetically interact with biology in a way that's meaningful. But I think, you know, from the pure creativity side, engineers are kind of the tinkerers, and biologists have this, I think, beautiful ability to work with the raw materials of biology to understand phenomena, to observe phenomena that we can then interpret through an engineering framework.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's in some ways it's analogous to architecture, I think. It's the idea that you have this creativity, obviously important aspect of creativity, but without the underlying understanding of the civil engineering principles, you'll have beautiful buildings that nobody can live in.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
But when you were here on your last visit, you and I were talking about your current research, and you were talking about using using chicken eggs.
Right.
And unfortunately, we got cut off in the middle of that. But you were talking about the you were able to sort of obviate in working with stem cells certain ethical issues that other people have sort of run up against. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a balance, you know, in research right now, because we want to do as much as we can to make our work relevant to human health.
Right.
And that involves working with human cell lines, which people are starting to become more aware of where those come from, how they're cultured and maintained, and that the kind of the ethical responsibilities that we have when working with those materials. On the other hand, you know, people have worked with model organisms for a long time. Things like you know, the chicken and the mouse is a particularly strong.
The Wistar rat, which was great.
Right, rats.
Just a stone's throw from here.
Exactly. But the drawback of those model organisms, even though there's perhaps less ethical complications, is that they don't model human biology as well as we need them to.
Right.
And so I think people are looking at stem cell technology, looking at human stem cells as some kind of bridge between those things. And so, you know, I think stem cell technology for me is going to be really important because, you know, my research goals are all centered around, can we take a design perspective? Can we take principles of development and build things with those principles?
Right.
And we can use things like stem cells that, you know, perhaps are derived from mature cells, so we don't have to work with human embryos as much.
Right. And you have alternatives like cord blood and things like that, right?
Right.
That have these sort of properties, not all of them, but at least a significant percentage.
But to be sure, you know, things like, you know, the chicken embryo is just absolutely vital to the work that we want to do, because there are many shared principles between, say, chicken development and human development. It might not seem obvious at first, but there are. It's just a matter of, can we take those principles and then port it over into something that actually is useful for human health? Can we make, say, regenerative tissues or tissues for regenerative purposes, where we're replacing, say, parts or whole organs that are damaged? We can do that by studying model organisms, but then bringing things like stem cells into the fold.
Right. You had mentioned that one of the great things about using the eggs was that you can observe them and still hatch them.
Yes. So you can actually, you know, basically partially remove the egg and observe development as it happens in real time, which is something that is impossible. Well, there are things that people are trying now, but it's basically impossible to do that with a mouse. So there's a lot of advantages, and that's enabled people to do. That's really driven a huge kind of wing of developmental biology, just that ability to observe in real time the processes that are happening, to manipulate the embryo in a controlled setting where we can do that.
Yeah, it's really it's just a nice thing, so sort of a nice alternative to have as well.
Right.
I think I mentioned this to you, but I can remember doing this in biology when I was in college, and using chicken eggs based on exactly the same principle, this ability to sort of see the vasculature as it would develop in a fertilized egg, and you could do it without actually sacrificing the chick.
Mm-hmm.
So you came to, let me just make sure that I sort of hit all the,
sure,
big points I wanted to hit. And so just sort of two general interest questions. So the first one is, you came to Berkeley, and you're currently, I guess, in this dual program between Berkeley and UCSF?
So that was my graduate degree.
Was a joint
kind of bioengineering degree between Berkeley and UCSF. And now I'm I worked mainly at Berkeley in my graduate studies, but now I'm at UCSF in Mission Bay, San Francisco, doing my postdoc.
So you've done East Bay, you've done San Francisco side of the Bay. So the big question is, A's or Giants?
Oh. How could I choose? I think I was an A's fan as a child before we went to New Zealand, but now...
That's a good choice, because, you know, they started
the
here.
Games. What's that?
They started here, you know, the A's.
Okay.
The A's were the original American League city for Philadelphia. They went then to Kansas City, and then to Oakland. Yeah. And the Phillies are actually the original National League team. But the Giants, the Giants, just from a personal standpoint, my family's based in New York City, and my grandfather's family were big Giants fans, mm-hmm, from when they played on the Upper West Side of Manhattan,
mm-hmm,
which,
mm-hmm,
is like, you know, in the 20s and 30s.
Right. But those games are convenient for me, because they're right around the corner from work.
Yeah.
So it's a nice, you know, there have been times when I've gone down to the game after work, and it's a great thing to do.
Yeah, it's a nice thing. Yeah. It really is. You're in Philadelphia now for the second time in a short period, and I assume before you and I met, you were here a time before then.
Yeah.
Had you been here before then? Ever visited the city?
I don't think I had.
So on these three visits...
I don't think I'd been. Yeah, I think that was my first time for the first visit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you had a chance to have a Philly cheesesteak then?
I have had a Philly cheesesteak.
You have it?
Yeah.
Okay, have you had one of these Philly cheesesteak called things that they make outside of Philadelphia?
Yeah, I don't know if I should weigh in on the conversation about what is the best cheesesteak, or which one should I... what is considered a cheesesteak and what is not.
So I'll give you the...
I'm going to get into deep water really fast.
Well, the main thing is that once you're outside of the Philadelphia metropolitan area, anything that is called a cheesesteak is by definition not a cheesesteak, because you're outside of this core area of cheesesteak invention and creation. But my wife, who is a major booster for Philadelphia Civic Pride, will tell you that should you try a cheesesteak, that the big tourist thing to do is to go down to 9th Street in the Italian Market,
uh-huh,
and go to what is,
uh-huh,
affectionately called Cheesesteak Vegas, because it's lit up
like
a Christmas tree, and you can go to the best-known Pat's on one side of the street, Gino's on the other. But in fact, off the beaten path is usually where you find the best cheesesteak, and I'll give you my personal recommendation is Jim's at 4th and South.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
So bear that in mind.
As long as I don't use a knife and fork, right?
You don't use a knife and fork. Well, you can use a knife and fork as long as you're not running for president, I guess.
Exactly.
Sort of the big thing, right? Thanks for coming in. I appreciate
it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was great.
All right, so I'm going to, you know, get some, lay my hand.